So, how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You see anything good recently?
Not really. We got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good. Welcome to Film Driven. I'm Steve Haskin.
And I'm Andre Shane, and we're back driving around the streets of Chicago. And finally, it's warm, Steve.
Yeah,
it's not snowing.
It's hot.
It is hot. It's too hot. But we're not here to talk about the weather. We're here to talk about film, aren't we?
Yeah, we thought, you know, basically it's been a while. We thought we'd kind of weigh in on the year 2013 to date, specifically kind of the first crop of summer movies, but also just in general the year to this point. I mean, we're almost at July, which means that the year's half over.
Yes, amazingly, the year's half over, and the crop of movies has been pretty friggin' abysmal, Steve.
Yeah.
I mean, this 2013 is one of the worst years for cinematic releases I've seen in ages. I mean, it's been really, really bad.
Yeah, well, we're not looking at classics so far.
No. So far, very, very few classics. And it's just, you know, I mean, there's several things that kind of jump out at me overall before we get into specific films. But, I mean, just an over-reliance on sequels, over-reliance on, you know, kind of extremely popular genre movies, superhero stuff, which we both love, of course.
Sure.
But it's sort of getting to the point where it may be too much of that stuff now. And I don't know. It's just really, really been a weak year. And I go to the movies quite a bit and try to see as much as I can. But we can't see everything. The year started for me with Jack and the Giant Slayer that my kids wanted to see, and that wasn't horrible, but it was highly mediocre. Did you see that one, Steve?
No, I did not.
Don't bother.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that for the second year in a row, there's been a large, expensive Hollywood release at that time in March. That has just bombed. And last year, of course, it was John Carter.
Yes.
And it's, I guess, sad for the producers of those films that it's become a new annual tradition, is that some large movie with a gigantic budget is going to come out and just fall on its face.
Yeah, it's turning into a bit of a dump for Hollywood features. I mean, Jack and the Giant Slayer was directed by Bryan Singer, who's made some good films. You know, it's not, again, it's not an aggressively bad movie, but it's, you know, it's just sort of there, you know? And it's just one of the many of these adaptations of a classic fairy tale that sort of they try to bring it and give a modern twist to it, and it's usually a very, very mixed bag. There's some interesting stuff in the movie, some fun performances, particularly Ewan McGregor, kind of you realize that he's not a young buck anymore when he plays the elder warrior in the film. It kind of makes me feel my age, Steve, when the youngster Ewan McGregor is playing those kind of roles now. So that's, you know, it's just nothing that you want to recommend to people. Can't say go see Jack and the Giant Slayer, and really that's the pattern for the entire year so far. I saw Warm Bodies. My daughter really wanted to see that. That's kind of a zombie movie. Once again, genre stuff. Warm Bodies, amazingly, one of the better films I've seen this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it actually works. You know, basically, Warm Bodies is a genre movie. It's a zombie film, but within that genre is a subgenre of romantic comedy. So it's kind of interesting because you do not expect romantic comedy to emerge out of a zombie genre, at least without like an outright spoof of the zombie genre, like Shaun of the Dead, which was actually great. Warm Bodies kind of pulls it off rather well, and the movie has, you know, some scary moments, but it's also fun and light and entertaining, and, you know, the leads are attractive and good. John Malkovich is in it, so that's sure. That's never a bad thing, unless it is.
It can be,
but not in this case. And that's it. And then, you know, afterwards, it was literally just a deluge of crap that I saw.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I actually really enjoy going to the movies in January because the movies that are technically new January releases are legendarily shitty. But January is always a time where I get to catch up on the huge crop of Oscar contenders, right, and whatnot that come out at the end of the year.
Right.
There's always things that come out, you know, at the end of December when you're doing things with the holidays, or sometimes, you know, just for the Academy consideration, they get a real brief release in New York and LA before officially opening in like late January or even February. So the early part of the year is actually really good movie going because you get to see a lot of quality stuff from the year before.
Right.
And then after that, you just kind of have your fingers crossed that between January and May, that, you know, maybe there'll be one or two, something that pops up.
Something will land that actually works.
Yeah, and a lot of times those movies wind up, if something does land, they stand out because it's not a crowded field.
Right.
It's lots of, you know, kind of mediocre. Usually there's some Valentine-themed movies and kind of middling action pictures and whatnot. Well, this year, I will say, from the beginning of the year up until the official summer movie season, man, there was a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah, a whole lot of, like, just aggressive nothing, it seems like. I mean, the next film I saw after Warm Bodies was The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, which is a comedy about magicians. It stars Steve Carell, Steve Buscemi, Jim Carrey, and James Gandolfini. And you'd think with a cast like that, they'd get some laughs. And by God, it is just a giant pile of crap. The movie, like, literally sucked. It was extremely unfunny. I mean, how hard is it to make fun of magicians, Steve? It's not hard.
It would seem as easy as pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
Indeed it does. And yet, apparently for the makers of Burt Wonderstone,
they pulled out like a crippled rabbit, a one-eared rabbit.
A dead rabbit, maybe? I'm not even sure if it was a rabbit. I think it was a skunk is what that was. Wow. That movie was horrible. And I'm truly sad that is going to end up being one of James Gandolfini's last films.
Yeah.
Because he actually gets one of the few laughs in the film. One of, like, there's like three laughs in the movie. He gets one of them. Probably the biggest one. So, you know, just sad and really kind of puzzling, like, why that would be as bad as that is. I saw Oz, the Great and Powerful. Did you see Oz, the Great and Powerful?
No, I steered well clear of that one. I gotta say, nothing about that movie. I mean, go ahead and tell us your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, actually, I didn't hate Oz, the Great and Powerful. I think the biggest problem with Oz, the Great and Powerful, besides the obvious fact that you end up comparing it to The Wizard of Oz, one of the greatest movies that Hollywood produced. You know, obviously doesn't compare well with that. But it also has a very, very weird and almost amateurish lead performance by James Franco in the middle that seems bizarre because I like James Franco. I think he's a decent actor. He seems completely out of his depth in this film. Like, he does not belong in this movie, both in terms of what he's doing performance-wise, and just, he just seems miscast. He's just the wrong guy for the part. You feel that. I mean, it really, really weighs the film down. There's some good visuals, some interesting ideas, and so on and so forth. The movie moves along at a fairly brisk pace and has some laughs, but man, I just never got over the really, really bad James Franco performance. And I think everybody else kind of felt the same way because, boy, I tell you, it's weak. It's very, very weak.
Yeah, I'm just so not the target audience for that film because there's obviously a lot of people disagree with me, but I never quite bought I think the whole myth of the Wizard of Oz is so overrated. Like, to me, the Wizard of Oz, I'll agree with you, is a great old movie.
Right.
It's something that, you know, everyone probably under the age of 60 has grown up with.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the Wizard of Oz, you know, it's just, it's this thing that's been on TV since I had memories. But it doesn't have, like, a myth status. You know, mm-hmm. it's like the characters in that movie are just characters in a movie to me. They right. don't live on in my dreams outside of this. And yet, every couple of years, somebody will have, you know, even David Lynch, that people will hearken back to The Wizard of Oz. Like, it has this power. Like, the story of The Wizard of Oz. And it has no power for me. So the idea of, like, hey, let's investigate the Wizard of Oz from, like, a different angle. I'm always like, who gives a shit? But
Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't have, like, sort of this childhood love of the Wizard of Oz because I think the first time I saw it, I was, like, 13.
Yeah.
But I did read some of the Frank L. Baum books that the Oz stories are taken from, and you know, there's actually a rich world that he creates in those books, and there's an interesting kind of metaphorical line that runs through those movies. So,
well, sure. I mean, a lot of people thought the whole thing was about, you know, a metaphor for America's turning away from the gold standard. I mean, that's,
there's a whole reading of the
Wizard of
the crazy conspiracy reading. That's fascinating.
That's a conspiracy. It was just like a economic, you know, that in some ways The Wizard of Oz was political satire of its time.
Right. I never really caught that from the Baum books, but who knows? If somebody sees it, I say it's probably there to some extent, or at least it's fair to point it out. But none of that. No political satire in Oz the Great and Powerful. As a matter of fact, Oz the Great and Powerful is not really taken from any of the numerous Frank L. Baum stories, which is what I don't understand. Why make a movie based on a kind of, it's sort of like making a Lord of the Rings movie without basing it on any of the Tolkien novels.
Yeah.
And also just completely going off the reservation in terms of the story. So it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It was it had some visual panache to it, but that's about it.
And neither one of us saw the other big Franco movie of the spring, Spring Breakers, right? We haven't seen?
Didn't see Spring Breakers.
Yeah, I mean, personally, Harmony Korine's on my short list of filmmakers where I feel they should pay me to watch their movies.
Right. Well,
and also, I mean, you know, if I need to go see young women get drunk and take their clothes off, there's always the internet on it.
There is. And even you could dip into your old stash of Girls Gone Wild VHS cassettes.
And probably would make more narrative sense.
Yeah, I would imagine so. So I missed that one. And, you know, there was a kids movie we went to see, like an animated film, and it was The Croods, starring Nicolas Cage. Boy, that was a gigantic piece of shit.
I had higher hopes for that because it was made by, you know, the same team that made How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah.
Which I first, for all the parents out there, How to Train Your Dragon is, as far as I'm concerned, the best non-Pixar animated movie of the past 10 years. That to me is the only non-Pixar film that you could hold up and say, you know, this is an entertaining children's movie that maybe, you know, 15 years from now, you could show a kid and be like, that's a great movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. That turned out very well. The Croods, not so much.
Yeah.
No. And so, I mean, I'm not really even going to waste anybody's time on really digging my claws into
that. I have a similar
one.
Feeling about I saw Epic, the animated film. And the best I can say about Epic is, I didn't hate myself, which is always a possibility on children's movies, but just thoroughly mediocre, nothing really
absolutely.
New.
Well, you know, they're just coming out with these animated films. They know they're going to make money.
Sure. Parents got to entertain their kids for so many hours every day.
There's just dozens of them coming up, and I think they're just getting worse and worse and worse and worse now that they're making sequels to the movies that were crappy in the first place, like Despicable Me or something like that. And, you know, people just, like, you know, in a Pavlovian sort of a response, just go pay money for these things. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times. They're just god awful, and I refuse to go at this point. I just tell my kids I'm not going to go see that.
Yeah.
And The Croods was one of the films that actually brought that about. It made me a worse parent. It's literally made me a worse human.
Well, it's a historically significant movie.
Yeah, it's a significant movie, I guess, to
life,
me. Because
then,
because now I spend even less time with my children. So, thank you very much, Croods. Fuck you, okay? I saw Admission, which was supposedly a comedy with Tina Fey and Paul Rudd. Two very funny people who are funny in a lot of movies. That was not a movie either of them was funny about. It was funny in. One of the things about Admission, Steve, was that Admission was, it was all about sort of this admissions office at a Ivy League university. I think it was either Yale or Harvard. I don't really remember what it was at this point. But I think a big part of the movie is sort of the motivation for this film is to sort of show, like, people that work in this sort of Ivy League academia are just like us. They're human beings. They have needs. They have wants. They love, they hate, they suffer. And, the movie sort of tried to humanize that world, and it completely failed, Steve. It was like, I really have a worse opinion of people that work in academia, in Ivy League universities, because of that film. Again, a movie is responsible for making me a worse human being.
Yeah, so that... The movies of 2013 are an active role in shaping your worldview.
They're shaping my world in a negative way, though. In a negative way. I don't want that. I want to be a better person. Not going to happen, though. Saw Oblivion with Tom Cruise. Did you see that?
I did not.
Yeah, that was
one of... Don't worry for our listeners here. We're going to make it to a movie I've seen pretty soon. But yes, tell us about Oblivion.
Well, Steve, the thing is, you're not missing a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoyed Oblivion. Oblivion is what you call a competent Hollywood product.
Yeah.
It's got Tom Cruise in it. It's got...
Tom Cruise, who himself is a competent Hollywood product.
That's exactly right.
That could be the title of his autobiography.
Competent Hollywood. Yes, exactly. Tom Cruise is fine in the film. It's beautifully art-directed. The plot is not stupid, but it is highly unoriginal.
Yeah.
So when you're watching Oblivion, if you're willing to forget every science fiction film you've seen in the past 50 years, you might enjoy it quite a bit. Or if you just don't think about that stuff, you might enjoy it quite a bit as well. But as soon as you start sort of looking at what we've seen many times before, then the movie kind of starts falling apart.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit sad. But Oblivion does stand as one of the better films I've seen in the last half a year, simply because it just doesn't actively suck. It's not, it doesn't have major missteps. It doesn't have... idiotic plot holes that make no sense. It doesn't suddenly take stupid left turns that are inconsistent with anything we've seen before in the film. So Oblivion is almost like a thumbs up, and that's rare this year, it seems like.
Well, I did manage to get out and see a couple smaller pictures at the Music Box in Chicago over the spring. One of the ones I saw, which is a legitimate original film, is this movie called Upstream Color. It was a big hit at Sundance this year. It's made by this director named Shane Carruth. He only had one other movie, which won the top prize at Sundance. It was a while, like 7 years ago.
Yeah, it's been a while since Primer came out.
This time-traveling movie, which I know you were not a big fan of.
Yeah, it put me to sleep on three separate viewings.
Well, I did like Primer a lot, and I saw Upstream Color, and... the movie had a reputation of being kind of avant-garde and confounding audiences. Having seen it, it's not non-narrative. It's unusual. It has a very unusual story, which, it involves people who take almost like a high-end form of roofie against mm-hmm. their will, and that when they take this pill, the person who gives them the pill is then able to kind of exercise a form of mind control over them. So then these people, you wind up taking this drug, and then you can get talked into signing away your mortgage, all your assets, and then, you know, 5 days later you wake up and you're fucked. And so the movie in some ways is this quasi love story between two people who did not know each other but who both had been the victims of this drugging and trying to piece together, you know, what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, you know, it's structured unusually, and as we've discussed on this podcast in the past, both you and I like structure, so you know, you kind of discover what it is. And I will say hats off to Upstream Color for it did give me something new, where, like you said, unlike Oblivion, it did not seem like a movie that was assembled from the pieces of similar movies you've seen in the past. You know, there's pigs involved. It's not a common, a herd of pigs is not often a plot device.
Unless they're eating the victim of various crimes.
But I still walked away from it, like, I didn't love it or anything. Like, I appreciated the originality, and, you know, I feel like the director did what he set out to do, but, you know, it didn't fully connect for him. So that was a little disappointing. The other one I saw, which was also a little disappointing, was another festival hit. It's a documentary called Room 237.
The Kubrick thing.
About The Shining. And In college, one of my roommates first kind of hipped me to these theories that, and my college roommate didn't necessarily believe any of this stuff, but he told me about, there were all these theories that Kubrick movies in general, and specifically The Shining, has all sorts of hidden messages and clues in it, like a sort of a meta-text within the film.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the theory about why The Shining, it's just that Kubrick got hired to do this Stephen King book, and that the idea of just doing a Stephen King horror movie was kind of beneath someone of Kubrick's intellect, that in order to make it more interesting to him, he buried all these clues in. Now, I will say that all of my research says that's completely not the case, that Kubrick himself actively wanted to do a horror movie, and he selected the property. And anyway, so Room 237 has seven people who each have their own theories about what's going on in The Shining. And the film is a lot of fun. It's edited in a clever way. You never see the people with the theories. There's no talking head shots. You just hear their voices.
Mm-hmm.
And they're given a titles, you know, like you get a name for each person, but, and then you just recognize them by their voice, and it shows clips of The Shining, and then also clips of other Kubrick films to illustrate these people's theories. I guess the part for me that was disappointing is I was kind of hoping to believe one of them, to find one of them semi-credible, and all seven of the people, frankly, just seem like they're just completely full of shit. I mean, so once you get over that initial disappointment, then, of course, the most fun ones are the ones that are the most full of shit.
Right.
You know, so like a guy who has a theory that is like, oh, The Shining, it's all this elaborate political screed about the plight of the American Indian. You're like, well, I don't really see that, and okay. But, you know, the woman who's convinced that there's hidden Minotaur imagery all over The Shining.
Oh,
now, see, that's a lot more
now
fun.
Now we're talking.
There's also one of the guys who is convinced, I don't know if anyone has heard this theory, there's the old theory that the lunar landing, where we landed on the moon, is staged.
Staged.
A common conspiracy theory. A little sidebar of that is the theory, which I had heard before, that Stanley Kubrick himself directed that footage.
Yeah, I love that theory.
Yes. So, my favorite theory in Room 237 is that The Shining is Kubrick's coded confession / apology.
Yes.
For staging the lunar landing. And the best part about the theory is that the guy acknowledges that some of his reading of The Shining might be subject to interpretation. But the idea that Kubrick staged the lunar landing, I mean, that's a stone-cold fact, Andre.
That guy accepts that totally as a given.
He says for you to not accept that at this point is basically like denying the existence of electricity.
Right.
It's just only a child or an idiot could possibly. But anyway, if 237, I would say, when it comes out on video, I think you in particular will enjoy.
I think I will love it. I think that's a great concept for a documentary.
But it doesn't necessarily shed any light on what actually is going on.
I don't want it to shed. I know what's going on in The Shining. I know. I kind of get exactly what it's about. I think. I mean, it's clearly about the American Civil War. But
I think that theory is also in there. Yeah.
But I mean, it's this obviously is right up my alley because it involves. Just people bullshitting about movies.
That's right.
You know, I love that, and it just sounds like a lot of fun. And also, honestly, it's an original concept for a documentary, and documentaries are so lacking in original concepts that sounds terrific. And both of the films you mentioned here at this point do have the advantage of originality, which has been so ridiculously missing from the cinema this year. That, it's staggering, man. It's staggering. And I mean, it sort of takes us right into sort of the summer season, which opened with Iron Man 3, which is a gigantic hit. I mean, Iron Man 3 is it's almost Avengers-level box office for that film.
Oh, really? I didn't know it did quite
It's pushing $1 billion worldwide.
Wow.
What I really don't understand is what people love so much about Iron Man 3. I just don't get it. I don't understand what the good reviews were about. I don't understand. I really don't understand why people are seeing it on multiple viewings. It's not that I dislike Iron Man 3, but by God, I mean, it's just Iron Man 3. I mean, by this point, we've seen Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark character for 3 summers in a row. For the last 3 years, there has been
Iron Man has been in
the movies. And at this point, I gotta say, I've had enough of him. I've had enough of the wisecracking, you know, kind of genius asshole that is Tony Stark. That stuff was pretty good in the first movie. It worked well. It was a different character. But that, you know, fourth time around, I'm just not amused anymore. I really am not. But man, I mean, what is the... Why are people so obsessed with that character, Steve? What's going on there?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people just like Robert Downey Jr. a lot more than you do. And it sounds like the world is not tired of his shit.
I guess not, man.
I know my wife isn't. I will say, you know, Iron Man 3, I saw it. It's totally one of those movies, and this sadly has basically become a theme for the summer where I walked out of it going, oh, that was a lot of fun. And 3 days later, it's like, did I see Iron Man 3? I don't...
Yeah.
I guess I did. What happened in it again?
Yeah, it was barely a day later like that for me. Now, Iron Man 3 kind of just blends in with Iron Man 2 and pieces of the Avengers. I no longer really remember what the friggin' movie was about. I know... Well, hell, man, I don't remember. There was a Mandarin, which...
The Mandarin reveal, I thought, worked pretty well.
It was fun, but...
My kind of overall opinion of Iron Man 3 is that, you know, they hired Shane Black, who has done some both, you know, straight action movies and satirical action movies in his career.
Well, he's a guy who wrote the Lethal Weapon films and also The Last Boy Scout and stuff
Kiss,
like
Kiss,
that.
Bang, Bang.
Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang was his directorial debut and, is, in fact, kind of revived Robert Downey Jr.'s career. You know, his comeback is really kind of legendary. But having said that, getting back to Iron Man 3, I feel I'm sort of at the end of the rope with Robert Downey's performance because I kind of feel that he's, you know, he was very diverse as an actor before he kind of flamed out in the, you know, mid-90s. But he was different, you know, he was different in every movie. He gave different performances. Lately, since he's become this mega movie star, his performances tend to be kind of the same.
I actually prefer him more in the ensemble movies, whether it's the Avengers or Zodiac or even something like Wonder Boys.
Absolutely.
Even if you could argue that his performance is similar, then it's like you're just kind of adding a little Robert Downey Jr. element
That's right.
to the story.
Spicing it up.
Yes. Whereas, you know, both in, especially Iron Man 2 and 3 and things like the Sherlock Holmes movies.
Which are terrible.
Where the whole movie is just kind of catered around Robert Downey Jr. shticking it up.
Yeah, it's...
I liked Iron Man 3 more than you did. I remember walking out of it feeling that it's a little more... It's less clever than it thinks it is.
It's much less clever than it thinks it is.
And I kind of wish that they kept the script but maybe hired a different director, because I felt some of the pacing in that movie was off.
Yes.
And that if you had a different director, it would not only help the overall pacing, but maybe someone who would be less in love with Shane Black's script and willing to tinker a little bits in it. I got the concept. It was executed all right. It was all right. It wasn't terrible. But apart from the whole Robert Downey Jr. issues, I mean, it really did feel like a movie that had no reason to exist. Obviously...
Except to make money.
Yes. You could argue that almost all Hollywood movies, the whole point is to make money. Yes. I get that, but it certainly wasn't... Yeah, I mean, there's going to be an Avengers 2.
There's going to be an
Iron
Man 4, too.
Disappearing, but...
No, he already signed up for Iron Man 4. It's a done deal. So, yeah. I mean, this stuff is going to go on, and he's going to play this character until he's, like, in his mid-70s, and people are still apparently going to go see it, and it's any discussion about it is almost moot, but, I mean, I got to say that I think Iron Man 3 should have been a better film than it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have easily been a better film. They could have built on some of the Avengers stuff and, even featured some of the characters from the Avengers, you know, besides the one that's actually in there, which I'm not going to spoil for anybody who has yet not seen Iron Man 3, which apparently is like some two guys in Nigeria. Okay. So, what can you say? It's a successful film, but I don't know. It just didn't do it for me. And the more I thought about it, the less it did it for me. Kind of the same can be said for the next film that I saw, which was Star Trek II, or I guess Star Trek Into Darkness. Sorry, it's not officially Star Trek II.
Right.
Though Star Trek II, the old Star Trek II, of course, plays such a massive part in Star Trek Into Darkness. Basically, a good chunk of Star Trek Into Darkness is an open love letter / remake / homage to Star Trek II, and that is exactly what sucks about the movie the most, where they basically abandon this new path that they've set for themselves in the first Star Trek film and start, you know, doing a big circle jerk to the history of Star Trek. It was unnecessary, it was poorly executed, and it really turned a movie that could have been pretty good into a movie that wasn't that great.
Yeah, I mean, the movie, it's a fun summer movie. I mean, like, it's got some exciting action. And,
like Iron Man 3?
Yeah, I thought it was better than Iron Man 3. Like, it's got a better mix of, like, action and comedy, and just that kind of, like, pop sheen that you're hoping for.
Well, it's got a lot of sheen.
But, yeah, it's... Like, one of the things that was so refreshing about the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek is not only is it just, you know, it zips along and it's fun, but they found a great way to, the whole concept of it existing on an alternate, like, timeline.
Right.
Meant that they weren't beholden to the old Star Trek.
Right.
Like, they kind of did their little bow and curtsy and then moved on.
Right.
And even friends of mine who were hardcore Star Trek fans, like, they applauded that. They were like,
right,
well done. Like, way to, like, get out from having to answer questions about where such and such movie fits in the continuity.
Right.
And so what was frustrating about Star Trek Into Darkness is that having kind of liberated themselves from the chains of the old Star Trek movies, they then seem to yoke themselves right back up to it voluntarily.
Exactly.
And, you know, it features...
And awkwardly, too. Very awkwardly.
Very awkwardly.
And you know, the first Star Trek movie, and we talked about this, the first Star Trek movie has fairly gigantic plot holes.
Yes.
And you don't mind them so much because of the film's energy and the charm of its cast. It kind of overcomes them. The second film... also has gigantic plot holes, But because the originality of the, you know, the freshness of that first film is basically gone, you really have to ask yourself, why did they, you know, why are these holes there? Why couldn't they just come up with a story that totally makes sense and doesn't, you don't have to like go like, but what about, why, you know, you don't have to question it so much. And then, of course, without the freshness of originality of being the first film, now these holes just seem like, you know, huge missteps. And at the end, I still feel the movie has enough energy and excitement to be an enjoyable ride. And I know the crowd I saw it with enjoyed it quite a bit. And I enjoyed it as well. But at the same time, you sort of have to view it as a film. Critically speaking, it's not a success. And I gotta tell you, I mean, box office, for what it's worth, I don't place a lot of faith in it, but it does reflect something at the very least. And, you know, Star Trek Into Darkness underperformed in the box office.
It did. Well, I mean, I know a lot of people, myself included, I was probably, out of all the big Hollywood summer movies, that might have been the one I was most excited for, just because the previous one was so fun. And, yeah, I was disappointed in that regard. I don't have the same love for it. J.J. Abrams, at this point in his career, and he really might be the new Spielberg, and the fact that he's a very entertaining, competent director who does not really generate his own material.
Right.
And so, therefore, is a little bit at the mercy of his scripts. He seems to be an excellent pop mainstream director. Just sometimes I don't know if I fully trust all, you know, his taste is not completely aligned with mine. And that's exactly what Spielberg was like for many, many, many years.
Right.
And, you know, this, I wish there was some way I could stop all of these movies doing shout outs to earlier movies.
Yeah.
And I know it's a battle I'll never win, but just ask yourself this. Whenever you're in a movie and there's like, you know, somebody from, you know, if there's a movie based on a TV show and then there's a scene where the guys from the TV show come in, like, there's no point to that other than
usually
for you to
no.
turn to your other audience members and, like, see who's in on it, you know? Like, look, it's the guy from the TV show. So it just
pandering.
It takes you out of the movie.
Yes.
And, yeah, this Star Trek has, I mean, I got no qualms spoiling things. I mean, one of the most memorable scenes from the original Star Trek II was the scene where Spock dies. Spock has to, do some sort of radiation thing, and he basically gets radiated to death.
Right.
And him and Kirk have this kind of scene on either side of the glass where Spock's dying and blah, blah, blah. And Star Trek Into Darkness just more or less recreates that scene with the roles reversed.
Right.
So it's right away, you're watching that scene and you're like, okay, I see what they're doing here. It's just the roles reversed and blah, blah, blah. So the scene loses all dramatic tension.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from the fact that, I don't know, I didn't believe for 10 seconds that Kirk was dead.
Of course. No, it's just a horrible
decision.
It's
a bad decision. And then they have Spock suddenly, like, screaming out an emotion, which is a bizarre character
doesn't make
choice.
Sense. Yeah, it's against everything that character is about.
Yeah,
no, it's lame. It's
and it's
just
also,
lame.
If you're gonna, like, I didn't necessarily have qualms with Benedict Cumberbatch's performance. Brief aside, that's the best, it's the most British of all British names.
Right.
But his character, both in the way, you know, as a white British man,
right,
and in some of his behaviors, doesn't really bear a lot of resemblance to the old Khan. Part of me was like, why do we need to make him Khan? Like, can't
it was
he just
unnecessary.
Be a, like, can't he just be a kick-ass villain
can't
in his
he
own?
Can't he just be John Harrison? I mean, it was
then he would go
plus.
Down as a new villain.
Exactly. It was a pointless homage and sort of reworking of previous things that were meant to be pandering to the audience under the assumption that your audience is so stupid and so unsophisticated that they're just going to salivate at this stuff and love it to death, when in fact, even people like myself who love Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, thought that that shit was lame. And it was unnecessary. And I think the audience I mean, I hope J.J. Abrams got the message. I really do. Because this guy is now going to go on and to direct the next Star Wars movie. And the last thing we want to see is these endless shout-outs to previous Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
We want to move forward into the future, even if it's dark. You know,
just tell us a new story.
Tell us something new. You can do it. You don't need it. And, you know, your comparison between J.J. Abrams and Spielberg is a good one. But, you know, I have to say, Spielberg's just a much better director than J.J. Abrams. Also, Spielberg works on his scripts meticulously. He is known for hammering out every single script problem that could potentially arise during the filming. That's why Spielberg movies tend to be solid. They don't generally fall apart, although, you know, we both have issues with some of Spielberg's, you know, kind of saccharine endings and stuff like that, and a desire to make everybody happy and leave people with a smile on their face. That's different than what Abrams does. Abrams seems to come up with a really solid overall story, but then completely stumbles on the details. Like,
yeah,
he underthinks story and plot elements that then kind of stand out as major holes in the narrative. You know, I'll probably watch it when I see it on TV years from now, but and might even enjoy it. But not great. Not great. Another disappointment this year.
Yeah.
I saw a film called Now You See Me, which is the year's second stage illusionist movie.
That's right.
After Burt Wonderstone.
And
talking about plot holes, really, Now You See Me has massive plot holes. But because the movie does have a certain degree of originality, it is essentially a heist movie, similar to like an Ocean's 13 or something, or Ocean's 11 even. It's a heist movie involving stage magicians and some street magicians as well, and it's pretty entertaining. It's got huge plot holes, like I said. You can't think about it too much, but it's sort of carried on. It's at least, how shall I say? At least it creates an illusion of originality. pun completely intended. And even that illusion of originality gives it something that makes it stand out this year. I enjoyed the film, and the audience I saw it with really enjoyed it as well, I thought. I mean, people seem to be kind of happy in the theater. They had a good vibe. And the movie's making really good money for its budget, so I think a lot of people are enjoying that movie. That's, in a way, kind of a sleeper hit of the summer, strangely enough. I'd recommend that one. I mean, that's still playing.
The next kind of big summer movie that we both saw, I know, was Man of Steel.
Yeah, Man of Steel was that movie that I'm a big Superman fan. I was really looking forward to a new Superman film that would kind of reboot the franchise. Because the last Superman film, which was Bryan Singer's Superman Returns, was not a... It was essentially like a sequel to the Richard Donner films from the 70s and 80s. And that whole concept, I mean, talk about lack of originality. I mean, the guy literally is making a direct sequel in the style of an earlier franchise. It was just, I guess there's a certain degree of bravery to doing that, but boy, did that fail. I mean, that was just it was terrible. It was not a good film. It was not well cast. The guy who played Superman was fine, or I guess he played Christopher Reeve, not Superman so much. But, you know, that film was awful. So I was really looking forward to kind of rebooting of the Superman franchise. And Zack Snyder, whose work I like, there is Christopher Nolan produced the film. I enjoyed Man of Steel, actually. It wasn't quite the home run that I was hoping for. It had a lot of problems, a lot of issues. But overall, I give it a thumbs up, you know. And I do think it accomplished what it set out to do, which was completely reboot and reinvent Superman on film. It did that rather well. The movie had a lot of action. It was visually exciting. It had a good cast. It had a narrative structure that was identical to Batman Begins. And it worked pretty well in this film as well. It wasn't a straight narrative. It was kind of a flashback structure thing. Henry Cavill, who plays Superman, Kal-El, Clark, was good. I liked him.
Yeah,
I liked his performance.
He's made the world safe for Superman to have chest hair peeking out of his costume.
Well, you know, speaking of chest hair, I was actually leafing through the Man of Steel comic book, which actually came out in the mid-80s, and it was DC's attempt to reboot the character as well. It was essentially a comic version of the Man of Steel movie that came out in the 80s, and I was very surprised to see that when they show Superman without his shirt, he also has a rather heavy chest of hair. I found that kind of interesting. I'm like, whoa, they draw him with chest hair as well. So I think the precedent has been set in that comic book that Superman does actually have some hair on his chest. So, but, you know, I don't know. What didn't you like about it?
Well, there was a lot of backstory for me. I thought they spent a lot of time on Krypton before the movie kind of jumped into high gear. I could have done with a little less of that. Like, you know, the first 20 minutes of the movie aren't really a Superman movie. They're basically like an alien war movie.
Right.
Which
right.
is not necessarily the direction I would have gone.
Right.
But that was one of my issues. I also wound up liking Henry Cavill. Is that how you pronounce it?
Cavill.
Cavill.
Yeah, rhymes okay. with travel.
Oh. I thought it was pretty good. They gave him a couple little, like, shrieky, weepy moments that I thought were a little... But I like that he seems both strong and has kind of a... Like, he has a good concerned face.
Yeah, he does.
Which, I mean, that almost sounds like I'm insulting, but I actually meant it as a compliment.
True.
He has a face of someone who seems like, oh, he's trying to be gentle and concerned for these strange Earth people that he grew up with.
Right. Well, Superman is not supposed to be a big... Yeah, you know, Superman, the prerequisite in any actor who plays Superman, it's not the greatest role for an actor. Actors usually do not like playing Superman.
Yeah, famously.
George Reeves shot himself in the head
because
he really, really didn't like it, allegedly.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a tough role because... You know, the main prerequisite of the role is to have an aura of decency. And, boy, a lot of Hollywood actors don't have that at all. And Henry Cavill has it. And he didn't overplay the part. It was solid. And, you know, he's also a very different physical type from Christopher Reeve, which was a nice break. Christopher Reeve definitely had that air of decency to him, and that worked very well for him.
Yeah.
He's still probably my favorite, you know, motion picture portrayal of the character, but Henry Cavill did a good job, and the supporting cast was very good, too.
Yeah, they did some... I mean, Amy Adams is, you know, I don't know, everyone has their own picture in their head of Lois Lane, but I'll say this, I mean, I'm a longtime Amy Adams supporter, but you believe that Amy Adams was actually a good reporter.
Yeah.
Which sometimes gets forgotten.
Of course, it's easy to forget it when Lois Lane can't figure out that Clark is Superman because he's wearing friggin' glasses.
So, the other parts of the movie that I thought were different that worked really well is I like that reversal that, you know, Lois Lane hunts down and figures out who Superman is.
Right.
I thought that was good. I also liked the kind of, in terms of Zod, the alien kind of revenge angle of how we got Zod to Earth.
Right. Well,
I thought that was a fairly credible, like, the motivations they gave Zod and his crew that I'm like, oh, well, that's a good way to get them to Earth and why they would be here and how they draw him out.
And it was also a good motivation, exactly, to draw out Superman because, you know, the whole notion that this powerful alien would at some point decide to put on red tights or blue tights and, you know, fly around and basically act a kind of as a modern-day god. is very weird. Like, what would motivate him to do it? And in this movie, I thought they created the motivation for him rather well. And unlike you, I like the Kryptonian angle. I like the fact that, you know, the science fiction aspect is woven into the storyline. To me, Superman's always been a science fiction character. I think the stories that I've always liked about Superman in comic books have always been basically science fiction stories. And this movie really ramped up the sci-fi angle. The Richard Donner films were kind of magical. I mean, stuff happened that made no sense scientifically. Krypton was portrayed brilliantly in those old films, but in a very sketchy way. Nothing was really laid out. It was all about art direction more than anything else. And in this movie, they try to sort of create a viable Kryptonian world and a society that was genuinely alien and had some alien belief systems as well that really seemed weird, you know? And I thought that worked pretty well. And you know, my least favorite element of the movie was actually Michael Shannon's performance, I gotta say. I found him to be kind of irritating as General Zod, and I didn't find him to be particularly, like, he didn't seem to have the gravitas to be a general. He seemed to be kind of young, you know, and his performance really struck me as one note. He yelled a lot, and, you know, he just seemed angry all the time. I really, you know, I could think of multiple actors that would have given that character a lot more dimension than Michael Shannon. So I don't know. That was a misstep for me. I didn't particularly like that, but
I liked it more than you did. I kind of bought him as the villain. But Michael Shannon is actually one of those actors who I've heard about for years, but through circumstance, I've actually not seen any of the notable Michael Shannon roles.
Right.
So it was kind of my first Michael Shannon experience. I'm like, oh, he's all right.
Well, I've seen quite a few Michael Shannon performances, and I have to say, most of them were better than the ones in The Man of Steel. He is physically imposing, so that was good. So, you know, when they went mano a mano with Superman, that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, this, to me, one of the best things about this movie is there's some great superhero fighting.
Oh, some of the best ever put on film.
So if you're like, man, I want a good superhero fight scene, then go check out Man of Steel. There's a lot of it. And, you know, the final climactic battle with Zod, I mean, that thing, it probably could have ended about three different times.
Right.
But there's some great fighting. There's also historic levels of property damage in Man of Steel.
Yeah, huge, that,
If you have a fetish for seeing buildings collapsing or things like that, then
yeah. You know, one of the complaints of the film was, of course, the sort of the cavalier attitude it takes with the property damage and the enormous amount of just blatant 9/11 imagery, and whether that's appropriate in a Superman movie that would invariably draw younger audiences, you know, and kids would want to see it. It didn't really bother me that much. You know, you do read a lot of, you know, it's a very divisive picture. Like, some people really, really hate The Man of Steel and are offended by how Superman is portrayed in it and all that stuff. And the term joyless comes up all the time in discussions of the film. And, you know, I thought the movie had a consistent tone. It didn't have the tone of the Donner films. If you want to see the tone of the Donner films, go see the friggin' Donner films, you know?
Yeah.
This movie was more, it took it more serious. It did not try to be a sort of comedy. It didn't try to be a romantic comedy. It didn't portray Superman in this kind of romantic, you know, sepia tone that the old Donner films did.
No, it certainly didn't feel disjointed or anything. That it had its vision. I mean, I will say there are some jokes in the film. I didn't find it joyless. I did find it dark, and I mean that in the literal sense. Like all the tones of the movie
it was
very
muted.
Yeah, and even the film stock's a little grittier. And
right.
I wasn't sure if I fully agreed with all that. Because
right.
It is one, you know, I understand if you want to do a serious, less jokey Superman, but more than the other superheroes, you kind of expect Superman to have some sort of, like, pop.
To be a little,
you know,
more,
like,
upbeat. Yeah,
exactly. A little more color, just,
right.
Just even his costume. Everything is very muted.
Right, right. You know, well, that's the hip thing to do right now. And again, Christopher Nolan produced it, you know. I mean, you're not dealing with a guy who's going to give you the happy, shiny Superman. It's not going to happen. But having said that, I didn't find Superman himself to be dark. I didn't
No. The portrayal of the actor was not. That's what I meant. I meant the look of the film was right. kind of dark. But yeah. no, in terms of the overall tone or the worldview of Superman, it wasn't...
Yeah,
it wasn't that dark. Though there was, I mean, this is a big spoiler reveal, but I have to say, I was a bit shocked that he breaks Zod's neck.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
that was, you
it
know...
It had to be done, Steve.
I mean, you could... There's a strong argument to be made that that is an example of them defying convention and giving you something you weren't expecting, but...
Right.
I mean, to be... at risk of sounding like an old prude or something, one of the things you look for in your hero, especially in Superman, is that how does he find a way to not, you know, the easy way out is to just kill your enemy,
right.
and that Superman is supposed to be better than that and find a way to not do that. In Man of Steel, Superman is not, at the end of the day, he's like, you know, you're right, I do gotta just kill you.
Yeah, whenever I read negative reviews, particularly on fan sites where people are like, that's not Superman, Superman wouldn't do that, you know, I kind of call bullshit on that because it's just, you know, Superman's been portrayed a million different ways. Yet Superman in comics has in fact, killed his enemies when he had no other choice left to him, and, you know, and some Superman stories are quite a bit darker than other Superman stories. So, again, you know, this was a very viable representation of the character. The movie's doing well. I don't know if it's quite the...
I liked it a lot more than I expected. And part of it was that, you know, as someone who's a big comic book fan, I actually have never been a big Superman fan.
Right.
And I also have a dimmer view of Zack Snyder than you do. So I kind of went into the movie... with blessedly low expectations. So then, therefore, I was
right.
like, oh.
Right.
It's all right.
Yeah, but, you know, the one thing you could say, expectations aside, one thing you can nonetheless say about The Man of Steel is that it's still not a home run.
No.
I mean, it is not that movie that kind of redeems
the
year
exactly.
or the summer at all. You know, at the end of the day, it's still... just a tad disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any desire to see it again right away. And it's not some, you know, if someone asked me what I thought of it, I said it was all right, but I don't, it's not a movie I came out of the theater telling people, like, oh, you should really go see Man of Steel.
Right. I think you've probably seen Man of Steel if you're going to see Man of Steel at this point. And you probably have your own opinions about it, but it is certainly a controversial film in a sense that it really divides its audiences. And but you know, it sadly it does represent one of the better films of the summer, and that's really sad, Steve. I mean, we saw World War Z as well just a few days ago, and I liked it more than you did. But, you know, again, this is a genre film. This is a zombie movie that has kind of a global perspective to it. That's all it is. There's nothing more to it than that. I mean, there's no character development. Like, you know, obviously people compare it to The Walking Dead on television. And, you know, Walking Dead has original kind of deep and multidimensional characters. World War Z had none of that. The main character, played by Brad Pitt, is a blank page. He has nothing going on there. He is undeniably good, unquestionably noble, very brave, and is completely no character traits outside of those positive qualities. In fact, he's less quirky than Henry Cavill is friggin' Superman. And, you know, I don't know, that's just weird to me that it was, you know, that this is, considering that he's in virtually every frame of the film, that he is that underdeveloped as a character in that film. It's bizarre.
World War Z really is a movie that's, it's like a horror film with all the meaning just sucked out of it. And traditionally zombies, like more so than any other horror monster, zombies usually... represent something, you know, that and it's changed over the years.
It has.
Like what the zombie represents, whether it was communism or you know, just fear of the unknown, fear of death, but zombies seem to represent something. And in World War Z, the zombies don't represent anything.
Right.
I mean, they're the only
they're a disease.
And the relentlessness is really the scariest thing about them. These are the fast zombies.
The fast zombies. I like the slow zombies, but it's the fast zombies.
They represent nothing. The humans represent nothing. So my biggest overall complaint with the movie is that it felt like nothing was at stake. You know, that it's
just the fate of the world, Steve.
It had no gravitas to it at all. And I will say, you know, this movie, and you know what I'm about to say sounds like a positive, and watching it, it was a major negative. Was that, I mean, the zombie attack in this movie comes right away. Like, it's like 10 minutes in, we're in.
Yeah.
But as a result of that, you know, I spent 30 seconds with Brad Pitt and his family, and then I'm supposed to be concerned about their welfare. Right. And I'm just like, who are these people?
Well, that's what I come back to, complete lack of character development. And that's, you know, that's a major shortcoming in the film. It feels slight, even though it has kind of a global scope. And the other aspect of it is, like, the global scope, scope aspect of things. Like, I love the concept of, like, okay, how about we take this zombie apocalypse concept and just spread it out all over the world? Where, you know, obviously they were trying to do that, and there is an amount of globetrotting that's happening once Brad Pitt's character starts traveling to different places to find the cure for the disease. But ultimately, except for one sequence in Israel, they are really inside of buildings all the time. So they may as well all be in Chicago or Iowa or Florida. It doesn't matter that the caption says they're in Scotland.
Yeah, because nobody...
It doesn't matter.
And also, no one had any interesting variations on how they were dealing with the zombies. I mean, even something like last summer's Cabin in the Woods, the Joss Whedon kind of horror comedy satire, there's little throwaway bits in that movie where, you know, agents of evil attack children in Japan or whatnot.
Right.
And then you see how the people in those different countries deal with those in ways that are very different than they're dealing with them in the U.S.
Right.
I mean, those little jokes in Cabin in the Woods were a more interesting variation on, like, fighting evil worldwide than in World War Z, where you're like, oh, how do they fight the zombies in Korea? Oh, well, they go into a dark warehouse and they try to shoot them.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
how do they fight the zombies in, where even was the World Health Organization building?
That was in Scotland,
I thought. Scotland?
Right, I thought that was Scotland, right? It doesn't matter.
That's the thing.
It doesn't fucking matter, except a very distinct, you know, sequence in Jerusalem, which was really cool. I mean, it was shot beautifully and was exciting. But, I mean, outside of that, there was very little global perspective. And it was also funny because the movie so heavily put, like, the United Nations at the center of the action. And it's... I mean, if you read anything about the United Nations, you know, of course, that would be the last group of people that would be able to do anything or get anything accomplished.
Yeah,
that's another story. They have an actual, like, naval fleet at one point in the movie, and you're like, what? The UN has a naval fleet? I wasn't aware of that. So that ridiculousness, of course, is a little bit of a glaring thing in the movie. But again, it just doesn't seem like there's a lot at stake in it. And the movie's engaging and exciting. There's a lot of action, a lot of running around, and some, you know, some scares and so on and so forth. But overall, it's, again, completely mediocre. And, you know, I mentioned The Walking Dead, and I just have to come back to the theme that we've explored on our show before, which is how much better television is than cinema these days. I mean, the movies seem to be stuck in a repetitive loop of genre films, television remakes, endless superhero stories, and stuff we've seen a million times before served up on a slightly different platter. And what we have on television are, you know, really, really interesting stories that engage you with interesting, unique characters. And, boy, I just say, skip going to the movies. Just stay home and watch your favorite TV shows. There's so many of them. I mean, obviously, Walking Dead is great. I mean, all the AMC shows, Mad Men, Walking Dead, The Killing actually is really good this season again. And you know, obviously Breaking Bad is coming back, and that's a fantastic show. But there's other shows that are fantastic as well on other networks. I love The Americans. I mean, again, you have shows for grown-ups with grown-up themes that explore interesting themes, that have subtext, that have character development. And that all of that is utterly missing from mainstream cinema. And this summer, it's just really, really hit me that, boy, I should just stay home and, you know, and
yeah,
and watch.
You have a much better time with your 2 hours watching a couple episodes of one of these quality shows.
And even when the show is based on something like the NBC show Hannibal, which I absolutely have no idea how that even gets shown on NBC, considering the stuff they show on that show. But, I mean, Hannibal, based on an existing property, you know, obviously you could sort of like, oh, I've seen this before. You know what? You've never seen that before. That show is absolutely unique. It has a unique approach to the character. It has a unique approach to the material. It's completely different from other movies starring Hannibal Lecter, particularly the Anthony Hopkins movies, which, you know, after the first one quickly disintegrated into absolute parody and are really crappy for the most part, except for The Silence of the Lambs, obviously, and, you know, the prequel to that, Manhunter. But that show is fantastic, and it's got depth. Americans on the FX channel, I think I already mentioned, fantastic show. All of that stuff is so far beyond what we see on the movie screen that it's actually kind of sad.
Yeah, well, and we'll check back in at the end of the summer, Andre, if the tide has turned at all.
Let's hope
like Elysium and Pacific Rim and maybe turn things around.
Let's hope. I think it's impossible to turn things around. I mean, if Pacific Rim and Elysium turns out to be two of the best films ever made, maybe we could say, well, hey, they came and redeemed this year. But that's not going to happen, and I think this year is going to go down in history as a really, really shitty year for film.
Yeah. Well, on that uplifting note.
Yeah, that's right. We'll end here. Until next time, I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Askin. Thanks for listening.
Summer's almost gone. Summer's almost gone. Almost gone. Yeah, it's almost. Where will we be when the summer's gone?